Welcome back to Passive Income Pilots, everyone. Tate Duryea here with Ryan Gibson. Ryan, what's up, my man?
We had somebody on this show today that I feel like a lot of guests have come on to talk about how you find a good market to invest in. And finally, we have somebody with like a real process to find a market to buy an Airbnb in. And then just drop some amazing nuggets at the very end about how to get really good reviews for your Airbnb. And also how to get really good search results for your Airbnb. So I feel like this is the real deal.
Yeah, this is where the rubber meets the road.
Yeah, and the very practical application for those that are using their Airbnb. You know, like this show talks about, the Airbnb can be a great tax advantage. We can get cost segregation. We can get deductions. We can get a life insurance plan in place with the Money Insights guys. And we can layer all these things on the Airbnb. And now we're going to show you how to optimize your actual property itself and run it. So, I mean, there's hundreds of thousands of dollars, you know, throughout the course of these shows and these episodes that are just waiting for you to tap, which is awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we've talked about the real estate professional status ad nauseum on this show, right? The 750 hours a year and qualifying for that. But there's so many pilots out there that can't do that. Like their spouse works in some other thing, or it's just not feasible, right? It's not feasible for a lot of people. And if you can do it, that's the gold standard, right? But if you can't, this is the best tax loophole that's available for high income earners. So tell your surgeon buddies about this too, because as much as, you know, Ryan and I would love to help you invest passively, if you want to shave $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 off your tax bill next year, you know, if you're a Delta captain who's making $750,000, $800,000 this year, and you don't have any tax shelter and you're paying 37 cents on the dollar to the government without factoring in state, you are getting smoked on taxes. So if we do the math here, you have $1 million property, right? You can't depreciate land, but you can depreciate the structure. $1 million property, let's say it's $800 worth of structure, and do a cost segregation study. You can pull $300,000-ish out of that structure. Does that sound about right to you, Ryan?
Yeah.
And then that's 60% bonus depreciation this year. So you take 60% of 300, what is that, 170-ish thousand, and you can wipe that off your adjusted gross income. So if you made 800,000, you might be able to get your AGI down to 600, and you're talking almost 50 cents on every dollar in some states that you're getting back from the government. It's almost like the government is subsidizing your down payments on these. And I don't think this loophole is going to last forever, Ryan. I think they're going to close it at some point.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting is like, well, my Airbnb is only going to make me, you know, 8%. I can make 8% in the S&P. But then when you consider the tax benefits, the way you can leverage your life insurance plan to do that, the way you can leverage bonus depreciation and cost segregation, the tax deduction you're going to get from it, it's all of a sudden that goes from like an 8% to like over a 30%.
Right.
But now you kind of got to manage it, right? You got to think about what's going to be optimal for your investment. And I think that's where Daniel just really strikes gold. And by the way, if you want to learn more about this type of investing, we have an amazing book in the show notes that you can click on and get from Daniel. He is the guy that's completely mastered this. Probably the best Airbnb guest we've had on the show, I think, so far. So really excited to jump in.
It is the best one we could possibly find. He wrote the book. He literally worked for Airbnb as a CPA in their finance department. He took a 3-month solo trip to Australia, became a nonstop world traveler with a carry-on, living in Airbnbs ever since 2013. So 11 years just living in Airbnbs. He manages over 100 of them. He's a best-selling author, and his books, Optimize Your B&B, were what I read while I was going through the process of standing up the Reno property that a lot of you are familiar with. So really excited to have him on.
Yeah, I think what's really cool is the story behind how we found this guest. Tate was literally doing research on what the number one best-selling book was and the best person to do this, and he stumbled upon his book, and then he just reached out and said, hey, do you want to be a guest on the show? And here we go. So,
which is a testament to where we've brought this show, which is thanks to you, the listeners, because if we didn't have the listenership that we did, we wouldn't be able to bring these types of guests on. So thank you. Please, if you haven't already, share the show, give a review. And on a quick personal note, this is pretty exciting. I am flying my uncle's retirement flight, going to New York.
What?
Yep.
That's amazing.
Yeah. One of the many reasons I wanted to go back to the right seat. He did my first flight of IOE on the 767 when I was 24 years old.
Nice.
And now, what is it? Almost 14 years later, he's turning 65 this week, at the end of this week, and we're flying a Kennedy trip in a couple hours. So pretty special.
I love it. Are you going to have like pictures in the JetBridge of his career and everything?
I don't know if we've coordinated that. God, you're putting me on the spot there. But we're definitely doing some special stuff for him. So it's a 24-hour layover in New York, and we'll be flying back on Thursday.
We'll have fun, man.
Thank you.
Enjoy the flight.
Absolutely would do.
Take lots of pictures.
Yeah, very, very excited. Thank you. Well, with that, let's get into how to optimize an Airbnb, huh?
Let's do it.
Welcome to Passive Income Pilots, where pilots upgrade their money. This is the definitive source for personal finance and investment tactics for aviators. We interview world-renowned experts and share these lessons with the flying community. So if you're ready for practical knowledge and insights, let's roll.
Thank you so much for coming on, man. This is awesome. I read your book. I reached out cold, and thanks for coming on.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm happy to be here. I'm happy to help get the pilots exposed to the great world of short-term rentals if done correct, which we'll go over.
I love that. As I mentioned, you know, I used your book, which I definitely want to point to for all the listeners, Optimize Your B&B. I bought both versions, the earlier version and the second version, and I used that all through the Reno Airbnb setup that all of our listeners know about. So I got a ton of good information from that. So thank you.
You're very welcome. Your next up is my newer book,
Profitable Properties. Okay, we'll link to all those in the show notes. Let's roll right in. Daniel, we went over all of the tax benefits associated with STRs and a little bit about your background in the intro. But can you tell us, what's your background? Can you break it down for us firsthand? Where'd you come from? Why Airbnbs?
Yeah, I came from Airbnb. Actually, I worked there as their accountant. And then I continued in that life, and I have gotten more exposure to Airbnb and different perspectives over the years, over the past 10 years, including some of the more interesting ones. There's lots of Airbnb experts out there, but I think I have. So I'm an Airbnb guest. I'm in Brazil right now, and I've been a guest basically permanently since 2017, 3,000 nights. That gives me a very interesting perspective into Airbnbs all over the world. I do property management, but I also have my own Airbnb. Those are two wildly different things. You mentioned I wrote the books. I do the YouTube, the Instagram, I write blogs, all that good stuff. And so that puts me in a unique position where I have all these perspectives and I'm able to see it from various different angles. And that led to my last investment, which was an international investment in Colombia. I'm right now going through the USA. In fact, I've already just recently been through the USA. Reno is one of the, I currently have it down to 211 markets. Reno is one of the potentials.
Okay.
All that experience led up to an investment I made, a very profitable investment in Colombia. And so I'm going to recreate that because US is a different market. And that's where your audience is going to be investing in most likely. So
right.
I need to recreate that to maintain my status of best in the world at Airbnb.
I love that. Well, my evil plan is to try and bring you back to talk specifically about international Airbnbs, because I'm sure the tax side of things is a little bit different when you're investing outside of the country. So I'm really interested to hear about that. And of course, most people, when they're talking about a very profitable investment in Colombia, Airbnbs probably wouldn't be their first guess. But that's for another show. Yeah, let's talk about the US market because, you know, for pilots who are making all this money, the only good loophole available to them, unless they're going after real estate professional status, as we talked about earlier, is short-term rentals. So what makes a good market? Can we start there? And I want to guide this conversation all through, you know, market, how to select a property, how to build it out and design it, how to manage it, how to rank in Airbnb search, all this stuff. But let's start with the market. So if somebody's going, okay, I'm not sure if I want to do this, but if I did, where do I even start? How do you find a good Airbnb market?
I define Airbnb markets into two broad categories, discovered and undiscovered. I don't talk about this in the book that you read, so this will be new for you as well, but discovered is what you probably imagine. Miami is discovered. New York is discovered. There's nothing wrong with it, by the way. I'll get into the differences, but they're well-known markets. What that means is we have a very high supply of Airbnbs, but we also have a very high demand. And then there's undiscovered markets, which are markets that aren't in the news, people aren't really known about them. They might have, ideally, markets have some kind of a draw. It could be a national park, it could be a theme park, it could be a medical area, it could be a place that elderly travelers go to. So it has much less supply. You're never going to find an undiscovered market on top 50 places to invest in the USA.
Right.
Or you might find it at number 50 or something like that. So there's less supply, which is a good thing, but there's also less demand. And so this is a key point. It's the variance between the supply and demand in any market that really matters. Okay, it's the variance between the supply and demand in any market that matters. What I mean by that is, if in this discovered market, we have, let's say, 100 guest arrivals per year, and we have 10 Airbnbs, that's on average 10 reservations per year for this discovered market. Now, if we look at an undiscovered market, and to keep the numbers very simple, let's say we have one Airbnb, and we have so a lot less supply, and we have 50 reservations, also a lot less demand. So that one Airbnb is going to get 50 reservations.
Right.
Okay. So that's the variance that I'm referring to.
How does one find that out? How do you figure that out?
I have on my other screen, I was just going through a market here in Houston. Houston has a medical center and world renowned. And so that's one of the things I'm looking at. It was one of your questions in the introduction. How do you find an STR? There's many ways to do it, but you just have to, what I would avoid is these lists. And I would just come up with a conjecture. Pilots are smart. So just sit there for 10 minutes and think about anything. And then you'll go in a rabbit hole. Is that what it's called? Rabbit hole? When people go on YouTube, but they search something and then they go down the rabbit hole.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a much better rabbit hole to go into. So I had a conjecture. I thought, okay, I think elderly people are probably good guests. So I then thought, well, where do elderly people travel to? So I did a search on that. And then that kind of brings you out to a bunch of different markets. So how does somebody find the variance between supply and demand? Supply is a lot easier. That's what's on Airbnb. Demand is a little bit more difficult, but we can back into that through the following analysis. I'll do my best to, I'll kind of just scraping the surface because it's very numbers based. But what you will do is, what I do is I go to a market, I use an Airbnb data tool. I recommend All the Rooms. I actually have a big discount I can send to you later on if anyone actually uses it. I think it's like 50%. So you go to All the Rooms, you get the data for a studio, one bedroom, two bedroom, three bedroom, four bedroom, five bedroom. You get the occupancy and then the average rate. And you multiply those together. So the occupancy is going to kind of back you into the demand. The supply is easy.
Right.
We have 21 right. studios. The demand we can kind of get to. Okay. And then when you go through this process, the really interesting thing will happen. For one or two of these size homes, you're going to find a giant jump in annual revenue. And that tells you, this is where there's a lack of supply, or there's an abundance of demand, however you want to look at it. So I just did that for Houston, the medical center, and I'm talking like literally minutes ago. And so I'll just give you some numbers. So for a two bedroom, we have 70,000, three bedroom, 124,000. Okay, so it's jumping up as it's expected. As you get bigger, you should earn more revenue because that STR is going to cost more.
Right.
So we're trying to look at an arbitrage between the size. Now, four bedroom, 164, 124, 164. Now, five bedroom, 357.
I see.
So I don't think a house is going to cost, I don't think the difference between a four bedroom and a five bedroom is going to be twice as expensive, but I'm getting twice as revenue.
There you go.
There's the demand. I love it.
That's awesome. Okay. So you're using All the Rooms to scrape that data?
Correct.
Got it. Okay. Well, there it is. All right. That's how you find a market. And how much should picking a market be related to where you live or where you travel to? Because I don't live full-time in Reno. I own property that's six time zones away. It's a little bit of a pain, but there's software that you can manage it. You obviously you're a globetrotter and you manage it just fine. Is there any words of wisdom you can give for somebody that's a little scared to invest one state away?
Well, how is it six time zones away? Where do you live?
I live in, Honolulu, about half the time.
Oh, are you kidding? I'll be there for a month, August and September. I just booked an Airbnb in Waikiki.
Let's connect.
Yeah.
Let's connect. I'm 10 minutes down the road.
Oh, okay. Oh, cool. There's actually a lot of really profitable markets, potentially. There's a few layers to this, but in Hawaii, a lot of Hawaii markets came up, and I'm not exactly sure why. I'm going to do it. That's going to be a whole state I do more research on.
So that's another topic is legislation, because the legislation in Hawaii is draconian. The state is trying to completely outlaw B&Bs across the entire state right now. So I'd love to get your two cents on it.
Okay, that sounds like just a bad situation to be in. However, excluding this outlier, I hope, it is actually good to have some competition. You need an advantage. You need to look into the details and see things that other people don't see. One of those things, I'll give you an example from a consultation call I had. I forget where he invested, but he invested in a market that had a lot of regulation, but he found a loophole. And so if you can get into one of these markets that have existing regulation and maybe difficult regulation, if you can get in, that actually works to your benefit. My property management company started in San Francisco. There was a lot of difficulty getting in there. But if you had one, yeah, I managed houses that were mediocre and making well over $100,000 a year, $600 a night.
Right.
So for me, I think there's almost always a way. It's definitely a consideration for sure. But for me, there's almost always a way to get an Airbnb. Of course, that's something that I'm going to look at, one of the first things to make sure I have to compare the different markets. That sounds bad about Hawaii for sure, and strange because Hawaii is a vacation rental destination.
Tell me about it. Yeah, it's an affordable housing play. You know, all the politicians are trying to fix the affordable housing problem. Instead of issuing building permits, they're just saying we need to get rid of all the Airbnbs. So there's your daily dose of common sense.
It's funny, as I get older, I realize some things. One of the things I realize is the best idea does not win. Typically, the best idea does not win. So the scapegoat of housing crisis, the same thing happened in San Francisco. And I forget the numbers now, but it was something like at the max popularity of Airbnb, there's like 10,000 Airbnbs. And the supply of potential condos for rent was like 250,000. So of course there's private rooms and of course people are partly on there. But if we assume that the 10,000 were entire homes for the whole year, that represents, that would be what, 10, 5, like 3% of the housing market.
So that demand study like sounds very calculated, and I love that kind of stuff. And it sounds like you had a lot of success with it. What surprises have you had with the market? You know, maybe you do your research, you see that the rents are good and the supply. Anything ever surprise you?
I think I'm too early in my process to. Okay, yes. I am. It's a very different market or situation investing internationally than the USA. And one of the things that I've come to right now is something that's not often considered, or I think something that is never considered, is the workforce. The local workforce matters, especially cleaners.
Right.
Because I promote self-management. And I promote that for a very specific reason, a profitability reason. I bought the Airbnb in Colombia. This is an extreme example, mind you. But it was managed by a property manager, and the owner was very satisfied. They were making $45,000 a year. Very satisfied owner. I took it over. I'm making $160,000 a year. A lot of that has to do with pricing and a few other things. But if you're not self-managing and you're giving it to a property owner, you are sacrificing somewhere between probably 25 to 50% of revenue on the conservative side. I'm going to manage someone else's in my building. And I asked him, what did you make with your current property manager? I'm predicting at a conservative rate, I'll make him double of what his property manager will do. And self-management is possible for sure, but you need a quality cleaner who is going to eventually become kind of your somewhat property manager. They're going to do more than just clean.
Right. Yeah, we've seen that.
You've seen that in Reno.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. We walked through this entire thing. Could be because we're self-managing, but you have to have that cleaner team. And we've been through three cleaners so far. And yeah, you have to have somebody who's willing to run over and take the trash out. You have to have somebody who is checking to make sure that the Sonos speakers aren't gone, to make sure that you know, somebody didn't break all the dinner plates and there's none left. It's not just doing the bedding, right?
Something interesting. So have you heard about an app called Turno?
Yes, and that's where we found all three, but now our latest cleaner, I think, will stick. But yeah, Turno is fantastic. You want to break it down?
Yeah, Turno is like an Airbnb of cleaners. It's a marketplace. Right now, they call it a marketplace, but you can't really do research so easily. You have to kind of make up a property name and then cleaners will reach out to you, but it's only good for 24 hours, so it kind of expires. But I'd still use that, and I'm going to use that. And actually, I'm talking with that company to improve that feature, because a lot of people, when they're searching, they're like, I want to see about the cleaners as well, especially if they're going to self-manage. But something interesting about, I know you said, I'll be back on a future date, and I would love to, but something really interesting about my foreign investment is the lack of problems I've had. And it's a 4-bedroom, it's a party house. There's people inviting guests over and having parties. It's exactly where there would be a lot of problems. And I've almost had none. It's crazy. And I think a benefit of international investing is people are on their best behavior. They're in Colombia, scary country, Pablo Escobar, cocaine. Where am I at? You know, I think that's it. Because it still kind of blows my mind how seamless this property has been compared to what I thought.
Very interesting. All right. Well, that's a surprise in the market. Can we talk about how to select the property? So let's say you find a market you like and the demand looks good. There's not a whole lot of supply. Most people would, you know, pull up Zillow and see what's available. Do you think that's a good strategy or would you look at other alternatives?
In finding an actual property?
Yeah. Like what do you actually go out and buy once you decide? And maybe you've already honed it in like, okay, it needs to be a 4-bedroom or a 5-bedroom or it needs to be this or that. What makes a good property for an Airbnb? And what would you look at and say, this does not?
We're arbitraging all the way down. I have another concept that I call micro neighborhood, which is once you find a market, Houston, then you find a neighborhood, and then you find a micro neighborhood, which is, it could be the east side or the east side of this highway. Okay, the east side is profitable, the west side is not. You need to get as specific as you can, even by the street. So I'm not a fan of buying without going to the market. I know that some people just can't do that, but micro neighborhood is an important concept. So once we find a micro neighborhood, that's arbitraging. Okay, of the whole city, I've arbitraged into the best neighborhood and micro neighborhood. Then we've arbitraged into what size home. Now we have two advantages that I can guarantee you 99% of people doing this probably have no idea. They haven't done either of those steps. Now we're going to arbitrage. And by the way, you could break that down, and you should, into bedrooms and bathrooms. Because oftentimes you'll see that you go from a 3.5 to a 4-bedroom and you increase by $20,000 profit. And that's not just simply for the 3.5 to 4 bathroom. Typically, a 4-1 is more outdated, is less nice than a 4-4.
Right, right.
Just real quick, I want to highlight picking a great macro market and then kind of going to the neighborhood and going to the niche. That is such an important thing to do in real estate. That applies to almost anything you invest in. And I don't think that's talked about enough. So I just wanted to highlight that. I think that's a really good strategy.
Yeah, it is a good strategy. It's something that a lot of people don't do. And it sets you up. If you do this correct, then everything else is going to be kind of easy. I have a saying in my new book, the most important thing you can do to set yourself up for success in the STR space, all but guarantee it, is choosing the right home and the right micro neighborhood in the right market. If you do that, you set yourself up for success. So how do you know a home is the right home? So some of the numbers I look at, I'm going to do two analyses, one expected and one reach. So my reach, and this is reasonable, my reach projections have to be revenue is twice expense. Revenue number is twice expense. And that reach isn't like Elon Musk's pay package where he wanted to like 10x the value of the company in a decade or whatever he did. A reach is something that's reasonable for your skills. You know, it's like, I'm going to be in the 90th percentile. That would be like reach. The other thing I look at is a 5-year payback period if we're looking at purchase price and total revenue. I want total revenue to come back to me within 5 years. That's just a metric that I use.
That's quick. I like that. Now, is that considering debt? You know, if you're buying in this environment and you're using 7% debt, are you allowing for that?
My property in Colombia will be 3.5 years.
Okay, so after we select the property, let's say you buy it, how about building it out? Any design recommendations, hacks, tips, tricks that you use for outfitting a property for a B&B?
This is my weakest skill. So I wish I had design skill. So what I do is I overpay for houses that look really great. But, you know, that's okay. That's what I do. So a lot of people buy fixer-uppers and then they spend 1.5 years fixing it up and making it nice. If that's within your wheelhouse, you can do that. I have a strategy where I'll overpay for something that's already ready to go and just hit the ground running. It's hard to say because there's so much variety, but you want something different. A lot of houses look the same, whatever it is on the house, look at your competition, go to Airbnb, which I think is another kind of underutilized aspect. Don't just go to the data tools, go to Airbnb, confirm what you're seeing on the data tools on Airbnb. Click open the places at the highest end of the market, or the data tools will even tell you the places with the highest occupancy. The don't rely on the data, but you can use it as kind of a rough guide. So differentiation is a key aspect in my process, something that looks visually different from the start right away. You'll know. You look at it and you'll know this is different. And then typically a larger house in general is going to be more profitable. And if you're going to be, whether you have a studio or a 5-bedroom, you're going to probably be spending roughly the same time. So for me, it doesn't make sense so much to buy a studio or a 1-bedroom when you can buy a 3 or 4 or 5-bedroom.
And the tax benefits are going to be bigger as well on that bigger house, right? So swing for the fences, I guess, as long as you're confident that you can book it out and you're not going to get slapped with some legislation that stops you from doing it a year in.
Yeah. The next question I have is really just, I'm really kind of thinking about macro markets. You know, you talked about kind of zooming in on the large, medium, and sort of the neighborhood specifics. What specifically, I mean, you talked about how you looked at the revenue per booking or the amount of revenue that you book for each, you know, available bedroom type. Does that apply? Do you kind of look at that macro, middle, and then neighborhood, or is there different layers that you would apply to each step in that segment to make sure that you're like, hey, I'm looking in the right city, looking in the right metropolitan area or MSA, and then I'm in the right city, and then I'm in the right neighborhood. How do you kind of filter that down to be like, this is exactly where I want to be? Because I think a lot of people try to invest from afar and, you know, kind of get surprised when they even get off the airplane and show up to the neighborhood that, you know, I don't want to be in this neighborhood. Yes, the demand is great, but the neighborhood is awful. When does that matter or not matter, I guess?
So on my other screen here, I'm looking at my document that I have, my vacation rental market analysis that's shared with my program. And if it's a big city like Houston, market data isn't going to be so useful. So what I do is I have what's the annual occupancy for the 90th percentile for the market, let's say Houston. What is the average ADR, average daily rate? And then I multiply those two to get the annual revenue. Now, if it's Houston, that number is not going to be so relevant because there's a giant variance between that number. But if you go to a smaller one, let's say Rockford, Illinois, if it's a smaller city, 100,000 or less, the variance is going to be, there's still going to be variance, but you can just look as a first step. This is the first step that I'm doing. You can just look at the total market occupancy and ADR. And then you do that for, I'm doing that for 211 listings. I'm doing that partly to share it with the group, but also if you're doing this on your own, you should be looking at dozens of markets to get, you don't have to look at every market, but look at dozen market. And then of those dozen market or two dozen ideally, what's the one that sticks out? What's the one that has the highest annual revenue? And then I look at, again, we're at the very general level. And then I go to Zillow, I do a search. Zillow average home price, Rockford, Illinois. In this case, so the revenue is coming out at $82,000 per year, and the average home value is $157,000. Now, I'm not buying the average home. I'm buying the 90th percentile. But as a first kind of go over, and then I look at some ratios between these numbers, that's how I first filter it out for these smaller cities. For the bigger cities, as I said, Houston is not so useful. So you want to narrow down, and you can with all the rooms, you can narrow down the map to your specific zone. In this case, it's the medical center area. So I just did that. And then I'll refresh data and I'll get data for that specific zone.
Very interesting.
That's super cool.
When you talked about, you know, driving that area as a last step, we've talked on the show about before, if the weather's okay, riding a bike, jumping on a bike, instead of driving for dollars, we've looked at this on some different strategies. Fly in on a layover if you can get one, right? Get a bicycle and just drive, you know, ride the neighborhood. And it really gives you a good sense of the neighborhood versus just driving by in a car when, you know, you got to keep moving. You can't find a parking spot.
Yeah, definitely. One of the things I did in the market that I'm in, Columbia, is first of all, I was very familiar with that market. Very familiar, meaning like I've made numerous trips over many years. This is unlikely for someone to do. But I rented an electric scooter. And I drove up and down all these streets, every single neighborhood, and I really got familiar. And I think I definitely attribute part of the success to getting very familiar. I even know there were some instances where there was a house a few blocks away or even one block away, but that street was inclined at like 35 degrees, where mine was inclined at 5 degrees. And I know that where that house is, they're going to have to be walking to the main area to get a coffee, to get a beer or whatever. And I also know that was a dead end. So when they order Ubers, that's going to be a hassle.
Right.
So that's an extreme example of getting very familiar. But anything you can do to separate yourself to find an edge is absolutely worth it.
Love that.
I had a thought, which is like, well, isn't the person booking your Airbnb not going to know that until they get there? But I guess you might be picked up in the reviews, right? So like they might be like, oh, wow, this one's like so much cheaper than that one or whatever. You know, they, oh, this looks great. You know, but I guess in reviews, I can start reading reviews and see that, you know, hey, it's on a different type of a street. So.
Yeah, you make a good point, and that's exactly right. The reviews. I have a 4.99 over, I think, on around 120 reviews now. Another interesting point that just popped in, I don't know why it's not relevant. Another reason why I like going bigger in these houses is because if you have a studio or a one bedroom, you could have the nicest one bedroom in the whole market, in the whole micro neighborhood. But at some point, you have a cap on your upper limit. At some point, someone's just going to rather switch out. I'll get a bigger space, a two bedroom. But if you're at a 3, 4, and 5 bedroom, you have much less of an upper limit. So there's nights where I've gotten over $1,000 because I don't really have an upper limit, or there are nicer places and bigger places. But and then on the flip side is when things are bad, you have much more flexibility in lowering your rate.
Right.
And still staying profitable.
Of course, and still staying profitable. It makes a lot of sense.
You brought up star ratings. What are your top 3 ways to get your reviews on Airbnb so good? I mean, that is a very good review. What's your secret? What's your top 3 things that you do?
Negative reviews are the result of mismanaged expectations. If you remember that, you will also get a 4.99 at over 100 reviews.
I love it. That's like a life lesson. So
100%.
That's like a life lesson too. Yeah, outside of Airbnb.
Yeah.
It applies in a lot of situations where, I mean, I've experienced it, I guess, numerous times. I had some expectations going into this Airbnb. They changed, whatever they are. That's okay. But if I wasn't made aware of it, it could be a simple thing. Construction's the easiest, the most obvious one. So you have construction, a guest, those have expectations. A guest is not expecting construction. I booked a place in Hong Kong years ago. My expectation is I have Wi-Fi, especially in Hong Kong. I got there and there was no Wi-Fi. Now, the host did not even select Wi-Fi. So you could argue it was my decision, my fault for not looking at that. But his reviews were also poor. I was one of his first guests. And so my expectation, all guests' expectation are, you know, hot water and Wi-Fi. So if you don't have Wi-Fi, or you don't have something, even if you select that it's not, you need to manage expectations. There's another hack, another trick that I do, which is during the reservation, I call it the reservation flow. All reservations have a very similar flow. The guest books, you're going to have an average, you're going to have a booking lead time. Typically, it's probably 30 days. So a guest is going to book about 30 days in advance. At that time, they're excited and they're going to want to plan. So you want to send them some recommendations at that time. And then about 3 days before, if you don't communicate with them, they're gonna send you a message. You want to avoid that. So at the 4th day before check-in, you send them a message. And throughout this, I'm saying, hey, you've booked a 5-star stay. The day after they check in, 24 hours afterwards, I send a message and say, hey, I hope you're having a 5-star stay. If there's anything I can help you with, let me know. It's a message that doesn't require the guest to respond. And then upon checkout, I say, hey, I'm going to leave you a 5-star review when Airbnb allows. And then I don't ask for a review reminder, but if the guest hasn't left me, actually, I do this regardless. I send a friends and family discount to all guests. I forget how many days after, maybe 2, maybe 5, that says it acts as a review reminder without asking for a review. I'm giving. Hey, if you or your friends or your family come back to this market, have them mention your name and they get 10% off. Or I think for me, I say $200 off.
That's great.
So my review rate is right around 90%, and the average review rate on Airbnb is 70, and that extra 20% I'm getting are 5-star reviews. Everyone who had a less than 5-star review, I can guarantee, is going to leave you a review. But those people who had 5-star reviews, those are some of the ones that are just going to forget about leaving it. So that's what you want to capture. And then when you get a negative review, it's going to matter less because you have a greater proportion of reviews being left on your Airbnb.
So something that I took away from your book was that you're really in hospitality. And I think that that's what a lot of Airbnb hosts get wrong. You know, we have friends that say, you know, they send this really aggressive contract that says, you know, if you mess up the house, we're going to charge you, or, you know, oh, we don't put blackout shades in our bedrooms because we don't want them partying. And it's like, you got this all backwards. Like, you're in hospitality. You're supposed to be taking care of these people. And so we've really, and this is something that I believe you talk a lot about in your book, right? And we've really channeled that. We have 18 five-star reviews so far, and everybody just raves about the house and the service that we provide. We use automated guest communications. It's going really well. And I attribute a lot of that to just this mindset of, like, you are in the hospitality industry now. Like, you're not their adversary. You are there to provide them a really great experience. And if you do that genuinely, you know, 99% of the people are going to reciprocate with appreciation.
If you may have, you make a very good point, and it's so easy because most people don't do any kind of hospitality. So if you just do a little bit of hospitality, 10% of hospitality, you're in the 90th percentile. I'll give two examples. One is, and tell me if you're guilty of this, be honest, a lot of hosts, they send this giant long message for check-in.
I hate that.
I'm not a fan of this, yeah, because it's not scannable. It's too long. A lot of it is useless information. If you type Airbnb commandments, my blog will probably come up. Respecting the guest's attention is one of the top priorities. You want to make all of your messages as short as possible. And so I switched that out for, like, you know, a 30-word message, and I have a link to a digital guidebook that's late arrival information, Wi-Fi information, trash information, guidebook. The other thing is I provide for all of my listings a guest itinerary, and I just make it once. And then I said, the beautiful thing is, every single guest, it's like a nicely well-designed. So I have Monday, do this on Monday, do this on Tuesday, do this on Wednesday night. So I'll send it to every guest and I'll make it sound like, hey, I just made this. I hope you enjoy it. 50% of the guests don't respond. They don't care. 25% say thanks. And then 25% are like ecstatic. They're like, oh, this is great. Like, you really, because they're like good recommendations, by the way. They're not just like top 10 travel, you know, TripAdvisor things. They're actually good recommendations. And so, well, this is one of the hacks I have that also leads to good reviews. Or if they didn't have a great experience, which all of my guests do, but I'm speaking maybe to other Airbnb hosts now. I think this is on audio, so I'm smiling if anyone can't tell, is it gives me some goodwill. It gives me some goodwill. Oh, whatever happened, the bed wasn't comfy, the blackout shades, which that is some crazy mental gymnastics. I've never even heard that before. Yeah, it gives you some goodwill. And there's some other strategies I have as well. Like, I do a lot of hosts give welcome gifts. For me, this is a bad idea. It's not a bad idea, but it's not an optimized idea. That's a perfect word. The optimized idea is a departing gift, because this is when they're going to leave their review. So you're giving a welcome gift 3 or 4 days before they leave the review. That's already worn off. So I give a departing gift sometimes to guests just when they're leaving and just when they're about to leave their review. And then also, if they had a bad time, then I can say, hey, I bought this gift for you. I'm sorry about the noise, whatever it happened to be.
How do you deliver that from afar?
I have a cleaner who delivers that. She goes the morning of to start cleaning. But if you don't have a cleaner going there, or the guests are leaving early, you could just tell the guest the day before, hey, it's in this drawer that no one opens. On your way out, right. I left a few gifts for you. And what I give, it's in Colombia, mind you, I give a bag of coffee, Colombian coffee beans, and a bar of Colombian chocolate.
Love it. That's very nice. That's a great idea.
I totally, like, if I think about my worst regret, or like the thing that I dread about using an Airbnb, it's getting into the Airbnb when I arrive, because my flight's late, you know, I get to the door, something's wrong with the code, and the checkout instructions. Those are the things that I dread. And I just very much appreciate you saying, like, you know, this word vomit of, like, here's all these things, you know, like a really long intro. It's like, just make it simple. Like, go to ChatGPT and say, hey, make this 7 words, you know, and just make that reduced, because I think that's really important. The other thing I love, you know, what the hospitality that you talk about, when we buy properties, it's funny, there was a property we bought in North Carolina, a storage facility. And when we walked up to the office, you know, it was a glass door, you know, open the door, you know, go in the office. And that door was tattooed with no smoking, no cell phones, no dogs, no this, don't even try that, no soliciting, no. And it was like, no. And it was like, you know what the door didn't have on it? How to book a unit.
<It's> like, right.
And so the first thing we did is, you know, got a, you know, a gun to, you know, warm up those hard stickers and like scraped all that stuff off the door and was like, welcome, thank you, here's a QR code on how you book, because all that other stuff doesn't matter, right?
Totally.
And so it's just funny how people want to, like, it's like you go to a roller skating rink, an old roller skating rink from like the 70s, the 80s, and it's like, no, like all, like a list of things. It's like, do you really think people, A, are listening, we're going to read all those rules, and B, like, are they adding any value to the experience of the person coming into the skating rink? So anyway,
totally.
I thought it was kind of funny.
How that happens is very common for a lot of hosts, is one person smokes out of 20 reservations, and then they put a sticker up. One person brings an extra guest, and then they put a sticker up. One person doesn't take out the trash, and now they have a trash. And then all of a sudden there's all these signs of what not to do. And then they're ignored because there's too many signs. If there's like one important thing, yeah, sure. But then they're just ignored. And the guest now ignores everything you say because you're wasting their time. By the way, I have a story about that arrival situation, which is a huge pain point for a lot of guests. Now, luckily, it comes at the beginning of the reservation, so you have time to make up for it. But I was going to Tulum about a year ago. I was in the middle of writing my new book. And so I was super stressed out. I was traveling way too much at the final leg of this book writing process. I get into Tulum at, I think it was like 9:30 p.m. Of course, I got ripped off at the airport, which is synonymous with Mexico being ripped off. I arrive sweaty. I've traveled all day. I've traveled from Canada. And the host says the keys are where they're supposed to be. So I go and I'm like, hey, the keys aren't there where they're supposed to be. That happens, you know. And so the host says, all right, I got someone, you know, coming over to deliver them to you. Okay, how long? 20 minutes. All right, I'll wait. It's just 20 minutes. Now 20 minutes goes by and there's no one there. And like 30 minutes goes by, I'm like, hey, what's up? You know, from a guest perspective, I'm sweaty. I'm uncomfortable. I have work to do. I have deadlines. It's 9:30 at night. I'm hungry. Do the restaurants close at 10? Am I missing out on the restaurants? So this host made numerous mistakes. They didn't properly set my expectations, and then they didn't reset my expectations. If the host just said, hey, I'm not sure, but it's going to be like at least 20 minutes, maybe 45 minutes. Okay, I'll leave my stuff. I'll go out and get some food, and then I'll come back. So don't compound your mistakes.
Totally. You know, on touching on that, something I wanted to bring up was a great point that you made in your book, which is don't try to make your property look better than it is, which is such a simple but genius strategy. Like if your Airbnb is mediocre, don't make it look really nice in the photos, because everybody's going to be let down when they walk through the door. So it's much better to have crap photos and have them show up and be like, oh my God, this is so much better than I thought it was going to be. And they're going to be ecstatic. It's like, if you tell somebody you're going to McDonald's and then you take them to Morton's, they're stoked. But if it's the other way around, it's not a good thing, right? So that's really good about setting expectations appropriately for what to expect.
Well, that's not a direct quote from the book. I don't know what you said. You said like have crappy photos is better than, so there's a fine balance between that. I get what you're saying and I stand by that. But a big part of the booking process is having nice photos, and which is why you actually don't need to use professional photography. This is an update in the new book I go over. If you have a modern cell phone from the last couple of years and you have some time to do with this, you can take much better photos, because it's not about anymore. It's not about the quality of the photo. It's about the staging of the house, which is more important. Anyways, that's a chapter in the new book. So this is why we don't want to get in that situation anyway, in the first place. We don't want to buy a mediocre looking house anyways. We really want to go as big and as extravagant as our budget allows. If our budget only allows something that's a mediocre, that's okay. Make sure the numbers work out.
Right.
Because then you're setting yourself up for success. But yeah, what you're saying is don't take, you know, wide angle, super bright photos. Don't change the photo so that when someone walks in, they're underwhelmed. That's something you want to avoid, because that will affect your ratings. And that's the circle of life. The ratings will affect the search rank just the same as the photos will. It'll just take longer and it'll be more pervasive. So take longer time to fix that.
because you said search ratings, and that was my next question, is you talk a lot in the book about the difference between Google and Airbnb and how those two different search engines work very differently. And so can you touch on that and how someone can optimize their search ranking?
You might be the first person to ever ask me this. I wrote this blog. I think this is a genius blog, and no one cares about it. Doesn't get much traffic. And, as I mentioned, no one even ever asked me about this.
As blogs go, I guess.
No, I have some blogs that do really good, but this one, it's just, you can't really predict so well. So I need to go back to it and maybe rewrite it. But so the premise is Google doesn't see the whole transaction. You can search for shoes, and whoever has the most optimized website for shoes or whatever will come up. And you'll go to that website and Google sees some stuff on that website, but they don't see sometimes that you made the purchase, and they don't see how you reviewed that purchase. They have a limited insight. Okay, people seem, their metrics are different than Airbnb's, whereas Airbnb sees the whole cycle. Okay, we showed these listings, these guests clicked on this listing, the guests who clicked on that listing actually had a good experience. 70% are reviewing and they're 5 stars. So that's kind of the difference. There's no hiding from Airbnb.
Right, right. That makes a lot of sense. All right. So how can somebody boost their rankings if they're already, you know, doing well? People are giving 5-star reviews like me, right? How do we make the Stoke House more profitable and rank higher in people's searches?
There is no way you can know your search rank. Does that surprise either of you?
Not at all.
A little. Yeah. All right. Doesn't surprise Ryan. Surprises me a little bit. Okay.
Doesn't surprise me. So when we first got into real estate, we were flipping houses. And Redfin has a thing called Hot Home, right? You guys have all seen this?
Right, yeah.
And so I was like, how do you make it a hot home? And so I emailed as high up as I could at Redfin, and they're like, yeah, we don't tell you.
Interesting.
Okay.
So, I mean, it doesn't really surprise me that like Airbnb would kind of keep that, right?
Yep.
Close to the chest. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, just based on my experience with like getting the hot listing on like Redfin or something like that.
That makes total sense. Airbnb takes it a step further, in that they heavily alter the results based on you, the searching guest. Now, I've known this for a while, but in my program, same name as my book, Profitable Properties Program, we did a little experiment one day to prove to them, because there's tools out there tracking your search rank. But as we now know, you can't know your search rank. You cannot know your search rank. So I had them all go to a city. We selected a couple filters. We made sure our map was on the same area. And then we all took screenshots. And the variety of listings was even greater than I had ever imagined. I think there was one or two listings that showed up consistently, not even every time.
Interesting.
So that begs the question, well, if we don't know our search rank and we're having trouble, what do I do? If you could pay for your search rank, I thought you were going to say they pay for the placement of these hot homes, but apparently they don't. If Airbnb allowed you to pay for your search place like VRBO does, then we could solve the problem. We would pay it. We'd be at search. So if we're still doing bad, we know it's not search placement. I have a 3-step troubleshooting protocol that you should go through whenever you're having trouble. The first step is optimize your online listing. I have the best strategies for that. There's the big three are title, summary text, and photos. If you have an optimized listing, which 98% of hosts don't have, but if you do, then you go down to the second step. And this is when you're having problems. I have problems. How do I trace where my problems is? Second step is hospitality, which is made up of your rank. If you're at a 4.95 or above, move on. But a lot of hosts, they think a 4.8 is good. The same trip that I made to Tulum, I had a friend there. She was a property manager, and she sent me a property manager of dozens of Airbnbs. And I wanted her to send me some Airbnbs, because as is similar with a lot of markets, there was no differentiation. They were all apartments. They all had a pool. They were all in this area. They were all in this price range. I could not, it was just going to be a random decision, which you want to avoid. So she sent me a few listings, one of which had like a 4.45. And I was like, well, why are you sending me listing of 4.45?
Right.
And she's like, oh, Airbnb's out of 5, so 4.4 is good. And I'm like, well, that gives you an insight into property managers.
Yeah, you say in the book, you know, a 4.8 is basically a 0. I mean, which is true. It's like, if it's not north of 4.85 or 4.9, it's usually not good.
Yeah.
I mean, I've stayed in really bad Airbnbs before that were, you know, north of 4.7.
Exactly. If you're on this show now, if you're paying attention, you're going to be at the top of the market. And so I'm not comparing myself with the 4.7. I'm comparing myself with the top of the market. So that's why I say 4.95, you just move on. There, you're good enough. But if you're at a 4.9, there is some improvement. Not a ton, but there is some improvement. If you're at a 4.8, there's absolutely improvement. And most people are at 4.8s, 4.7s, most hosts. So the third step, if you have number one and number two covered, the third step is pricing, which is a whole other topic that gives hosts the most issues and could fill out easily another hour talking about that. But
yeah,
I have my own pricing strategy. It was not covered in Optimize Your B&B. It is covered, part five, pricing in Profitable Properties, which is the new book. And I talk about my strategy, which is different from any other strategy that I had. And once you learn it, it takes 30 seconds a week. It is the best strategy out there, bar none, minus if you have the budget to hire a data team that can go in and do it manually and, you know, like Southwest does. If you have
right.
If you have that budget, then yeah, that's probably a better option. But given the return on investment from the time you're taking and the profit you're making, there, I have some free videos online as well. All these topics, I have free videos. If you just search whatever topic you want, optimize my Airbnb title. Well, that has my name in it, but whatever topic you want, title, and then Airbnb and optimize my brand name at the end, my videos and blogs will come up on Google, probably.
Well, all right. So we got to wind this down, but before we do, favorite software tools that you couldn't live without?
Automated messaging definitely saves me a lot of time. That's better known as PMS, property management software. There's so many good ones out there that I don't really recommend a specific one. I do have a video, which is how do I choose a PMS? And I talk about the things you want to consider so you don't have to switch into the future. But basically, all of them are very good. The other software is pricing software. Absolutely gives a giant ROI, especially if you have a strategy going into it. And the other one would be a digital guidebook, which gives the check and info, checkout info.
Yeah, which is something that we've struggled to find a good one for that. So what do you use for a digital guidebook? Do you use the Airbnb functionality or do you use something else?
No, I use a company called Hostfully. And they have a free digital guidebook. One is just free. They have a paid upgrade, but you really don't need it.
Right. And Hostfully is a PMS. It's a property management software, correct?
Yes. Now it is. Yes. It started off as just a digital guidebook and then they have a PMS, but they have these kind of two businesses. The digital guidebook works together well with the PMS.
Gotcha.
And if you decide to use that PMS or use that or upgrade the digital guidebook, as is true on many tools, if you type in the discount code Optimize, you'll probably get a little discount as a hack to save some money. Those are the three top tools that I would recommend.
Very cool. Daniel, we're going to have you back for some more talk on, well, we didn't get to some of the nuts and bolts that I wanted to, but as well, I want to talk about the international stuff because we have a lot of pilots who are flying all over the world. We'd be super interested in some of these international markets and how you manage that while yourself traveling abroad. So hope to connect with you on a future episode.
Well, I just want to say one thing because you've mentioned it a few times, so I don't know if your group is already kind of somewhat interested in international market, and I'll make it quick, but if you're investing in international, understand that you are investing international. That means typically less safe. So there's a lot of companies that have popped up where they make it easy for you to bring your money in and invest. And then they're promoting returns of like 10%, 11%, 12%. That's not acceptable. Okay, you need 20%, 30% to invest internationally.
100% agree. That's such a good point. Well, with that, Daniel, how do people find out more about you? We're going to link to your books in the show notes. Again, I appreciate the information that you wrote down. Took the time to write down because I personally benefited from it on my Airbnb build out. But how do people find out more about you and your videos and your website and all that sort of stuff?
You can type in on Google Daniel Rustin, and what you'll find is my two books, Optimize Your Airbnb, which is the one I wrote in 2018 and still the bestseller. There's a new one I just published last year, Profitable Properties, and I released an online program with that book. It's called the Profitable Properties Program. And you also find my YouTube, my Instagram, all my Twitter, all my stuff there. And I hope to see at least some of you guys. I'm spending most of my time in my program, so I hope to see some of y'all in that program. The next class is coming up in a couple weeks.
We have a link in the show notes right now, straight to this program. I'm going to check it out because Lucy and I had a blast setting up Reno. We're having a lot of success with it, and the tax write-offs are insane. So the more coaching I can get on the Airbnb side, the better. So thanks, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Dan.
Yeah, I'm sharing all of my STR USA market research in there as well.
Fantastic. Well, with that, thank you so much for coming on the show. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you have questions to follow up with, you can go to ask@passiveincomepilots.com or post it in the Facebook group, Passive Income Pilots on Facebook. We'll talk to you there. And thank you again, Daniel Rustine, for sharing your wisdom. Much appreciated.
Thanks for having me.
Catch you on the next show.